Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It gives me very great pleasure to welcome you here tonight to this year's BP Visiting Centennial Professorial Lecture, or rather the first of two. James Olson was born in Sweden, but he was educated for a brief, fleeting, but no doubt formative period in Rickmansworth. But he then went back to Sweden for his bachelor's degree, emigrated to the west coast of America for his master's, where he began his university teaching career. He was both at Stanford and then subsequently and for a longer period at the University of California at Berkeley. Recently, in July 1987, he moved back to the east coast and joined Columbia University, where he's been George O. May Professor of Accounting. Professor Olson has a formidable reputation in the field. He's editor of numerous accounting journals and has published extensively in the field. And in view of BP's interests, amongst his many publications, is one that bears very heavily on the accounting treatment of gas and oil fields. So I'm sure our fellow hosts on this occasion from BP will be joining with us with anticipation to hear the first of two lectures on accounting information and corporate valuation. Professor Olson.
So I'm actually not going to talk about oil and gas accounting. What I'm going to talk about is a much more basic problem, and it has to do with the nature of capital budgeting. When it comes to capital budgeting, you always have to think about it in terms of a two-stage process. First, there are certain predictions that are necessary, and these predictions relate to future financial statements, income statement, balance sheet, and cash flows, typically. And the second stage in the capital budgeting problem then has to do with the problem I'm going to address, and that's sort of the nature of appropriate value inferences. So we've got to keep in mind here is that when it comes to capital budgeting, in the end, a decision has to be made. Accurate forecasts can be viewed as a necessary condition for making a good decision, but it's certainly not a sufficient condition. So when you look at what happens next in the process here, we find that there are all sorts of prescriptions. If you look at corporate finance textbooks, they tend, at least during the last 20 years, always to emphasize that when you're concerned with value inferences, the right way of going is always to focus on the present value of cash flows. So the idea here is that if you try to pay attention to something else but cash flows, you probably end up in trouble. This has been around for at least 20 years, and if you pick up any finance textbook, this is what you always typically find. However, if you actually check out what people do in practice, you find that the issues are much, much more complicated. I've examined several documents that relates to corporate capital budgeting decisions. And usually what you find is sort of an attempt to use present value of cash flows. But in the end, it's sort of nice to just sort of take a quick glance, if nothing else, at the accounting numbers. So that sort of leads to the whole issue that I'm going to talk about tonight here, is that when you do capital budgeting, what is it that you really need to worry about? Cash flows, or do you actually want to look at earnings as calculated by the accountant, in other words, earnings based on accrual accounting? Now, of course, keep in mind here the fact one is looking at accrual accounting does not mean that we neglect the cash flows. It simply means that we're looking at measurements that go beyond the cash flows when we look at the capital budgeting problem. So that's sort of what we're going to talk about here tonight. And it's worthwhile to note here that the conceptual foundations concerning this problem is not as clear-cut as one might think. Again, if you read corporate finance textbooks, you will sort of they sort of will tell you that the right way of going is always look at the present value of cash flows. However, if you go further back in time, the 1940s, the 1950s, and so forth, you will actually find a literature that suggests that their approach is other than the present value of cash flows. And these are sort of the ones I'm going to bring up today here, and I'm going to try to convince you that that kind of literature is of great importance. Let me summarize the basic points I'm going to make. There are three points I'd like to make. The first point is very straightforward. Once you understand the problem of capital budgeting, you're going to arrive at the conclusion that there are absolutely no compelling reasons why one has to focus on the present value of cash flows. In other words, there are alternatives to the present value of cash flows that are equally valid from a conceptual point of view. So in some sense, the reality here is that we face a variety of different approaches depending upon the accounting measurements, and all of these approaches in principle and conceptually are equally valid. So the only justification here for using cash flow analysis, in other words, the present value of cash flows, really hinges upon that under certain circumstances you may use different approaches. All these different approaches may then, and you might know that in advance, might then give you the same solution. Under such conditions, it might very well be worthwhile to, in some sense, to use the simplest approach from a point of view of accounting measures. In other words, you neglect them. So under some circumstances here, it is indeed the case that you may use the present value of cash flows and you will arrive at the correct solution. However, having said that, it's important to appreciate that just because you introduce accrual accounting measures, it does not mean that you're going to arrive at the incorrect solution. Okay, the third point here has to do with the sort of a rather obvious yet subtle point is that if you want to start to do your capital budget on the basis of projected earnings and so forth, somewhere along the line, we have to ask questions about what properties are the accounting principles are satisfied. And that sort of really gets to the heart of the problem. I think one can fairly state that if you look at the whole capital budgeting problem from the historical point of view, what happened was during the 1950s and 1960s is that when people abandoned the notion of looking at projected earnings and balance sheet was that, well, if you don't tell me what the right accounting principles are, then I don't really care about the accounting numbers, and therefore I sort of better stick to basics and just look to the cash flows. So there's always this notion lurking in the background here is that if you want to do accounting, what is the right accounting? So I'm going to try to give you a sense of how that problem can be addressed in practice. I can't tell you what the best accounting is, but I can tell you what properties a good accounting system ought to satisfy if you want to use projected accounting numbers in your capital budgeting decision. Let me next review what I can refer to as being the textbook approach to capital budgeting. It sort of helps to appreciate in terms of what the issues are. So all I plan to do here for the next few minutes is sort of to review concepts with which most of you are quite familiar. It's simply the standard corporate finance capital budgeting approach. And it really revolves around very few concepts. The first, of course, is that you should only focus on the expected cash flows. And some textbooks leave you no doubt about that. They tell you that's the only thing that really will give you the right solution. So sort of like a second point here, there should be no need, at least in principle, to focus on future earnings. And then, of course, the next thing that you need to know is the discount rate. And I don't really have that much to add about that issue, certainly not at this point. But most of you are probably familiar with the fact that when it comes to the discount rate, one introduces the notion of cost of capital, and then one tries to estimate or measure the cost of capital on the basis of stock market data, and one might want to apply a model such as CAPM, APT, and whatever have you. In the end, one is supposed to end up with a discount rate. So that's all the input we really need, expected cash flows, and then we have our discounts, and then we can estimate the value of a project by taking the present value. Notice here that you introduce a subscript T, and that refers to the project horizon. In other words, that's sort of the actual horizon of the project, rather than what you might call the pro forma horizon. In other words, the number of years you actually look at in terms of projected financial statements. So I think it's very important at this point to recognize that in practice, for many capital budgeting decisions, the project horizon is going to be infinite. So what you can think about to make life simple for yourself is that we can visualize that we have a company that wants to acquire another company. And of course, in that case, the acquired company is going to be a going concern. So when you ask questions about what's going to happen to this company in the future, well, you sit down and make your projections, and in principle, you should go to infinity, but that's of course not what happens. Before I talk about that in greater detail, let me sort of just add a point here, which is a rather minor point at this point in time, but I'm going to come back to it later on. And what it simply says here is that when you think about... this is not working here. Can you see this? Is that when you think about the present value of a stream of cash flows, you can think about sort of like a three-stage procedure. First, you add all the cash flows together. Then you look at their timing, and what you visualize is that these cash flows could be deposited in a savings account, and then it would have a certain earnings. So you get certain earnings in your cash flow. So what you have in the numerator here now is a stock of wealth, which is going to be available at the end of the project horizon, and then you discount that back. Now, if you go through these kind of calculations here, the one thing that you're going to find out here is that the second term in the numerator tends to be very important if a project horizon is long. On the other hand, for short project horizons, then it really sort of suffices to add up the cash flows and you get a very good approximation. Okay, so that's how things stand here. And once people in the business world try to apply these concepts, they run into an incredible number of problems. And you really have to examine the documents related to these kind of capital expenditures capital expenditure decisions to really get a feeling for it. The first problem that always tends to pop up, of course, is that we need some definition of cash flows. For practitioners, that's usually not as easy as it sounds, but at least in concept, and I think even in terms of actual measurements, it's fairly straightforward. The corporate finance textbooks, they prescribe that you're supposed to use so-called free cash flows. And essentially, the key concept here is that when you think about the cash flows, it's the cash flows from operations minus any future capital expenditures. Okay, the second thing one quickly learns, and some of you might even have learned that as students, if you ever engage in these kind of projects, is that the actual conclusion you end up in terms of estimated value of a project or a business tends to be remarkably sensitive to the discount factor. So even small changes in the discount factor can have a very significant impact on the estimated value, and that tends, of course, to be particularly the case when you have a very long project horizon. Because of these concerns here, in the second point, what happens in applications is that people rarely actually use a pure cash flow approach. What we typically have to do is to introducing the notion of a continuing value. So the approach here is modified here. We calculate the expected value of a project sort of like a two-stage procedure. First, we take the present value of certain cash flows up to an horizon date. And this is sort of the planning horizon. So you can sort of visualize that if you prepare projected financial statements, you don't want to do it for 900 years. You probably want to do something much less. In practice, as far as I can judge, it sort of tends to vary between 5 and 15 years. Occasionally, when you have less uncertainty, you find that projected financial statements tend to be for longer periods. So you notice here that the practical horizon in terms of projected financial statements tend to be less than the project horizon. under unusual circumstances, you may actually have a case when the capital A is equal to the capital T, and that occurs if the project is a very discrete, finite project, like in investing in some equipment or something like that, which is sort of worthless after 10 years. But in general, in practice, if a company is engaged in a capital expenditure decision where you have where you have an infinite project, then typically you have to make some decision as to how far you want to go in terms of generating projected financial statements. Now, once you start looking at the problem from this point of view, it raises a number of very tricky questions. One question, of course, is simply how do you determine the continuing value? And it's sort of interesting to read the textbooks, because what typically happens now is that they deviate from the pure present value of cash flows approach. And this is sort of a reality. In principle, you can sort of see some people who argue that, well, you should just take the cash flows beyond that point, come up with the best estimate, use some perpetuity, or something like that. But in reality, this is where accounting data seems to come, at least in most cases, seems to come into play when you try to estimate the continuing value. Okay, the sort of related issue, of course, is how do we determine the horizon? So do you want to work with 5 years, 10 years, or 15 years? So that's something of great importance in practice. And what I hope to be able to do is to address these issues. Okay. There are some other points here I would like to make. First point, as a practical matter, it tends to be the case that most of the value is in the continuing value rather than the present value of the cash flows for the horizon period. And that, of course, tends to be particularly the case if you visualize that the capital expenditure relates to a project where you're going to have future capital expenditures. Only if you have a liquidating project can you expect that the first term, in other words, the present value of cash flows, is more important than the continuing value term. So somewhat remarkably here, sort of given the effort textbooks usually goes to trying to describe the techniques, is that in many, many cases, if you want to come up with a useful approximation, just ask what the continuing value is going to be, and then discount it back. And that's sort of a rather awkward way of thinking about it. You know, you're asking the question here, how much is this project worth today? And then answer, look at what the project is worth 5 years down the line, and then discount back. It sort of seems that something is remiss here. So in the end, you know, you can take it to the extreme. Why not make the planning horizon zero and just look at what's happening right now? Well, that's too extreme, but it's clear here that what we need to do is sort of start from the beginning. So the key point I'd like to make at this point here before I go on is that the crux of the matter here has much to do with the fact that we're introducing a continuing value. Once we want to introduce a continuing value, then we do not want to just sort of use arbitrary formula that tells us that this is sort of an estimate of a continuing value. In practice, you can find such things as 10 times earnings at the horizon date, or whatever have you. And that may be reasonable, and on the other hand, it may not be reasonable. So what we really want to do now is to think about the whole capital budgeting problem from basics. So we're sort of going to start from the beginning here. And to move on to that problem here, I'm actually going back 50 years in time. And there was, at that point in time, I think this was in 1936, so it's not quite 50 years. There was an article written by an American, his name was Preinrich, which was published in Econometrica. And the name of the paper had something to do with the theory of depreciation. He mentioned, incidentally, at a point in time, that value, in fact, is just determined by something that nowadays is referred to as economic value added, It's the book value plus the present value of residual earnings. And interestingly enough, in the footnote, he's already mentioned that, of course, that's how you do it in practice. So that's rather remarkable, and it turns out that this formula here has sort of been around in the literature for the past 50 years. It almost dropped out of sight in the late 60s, except that it did not, in fact, happen in Europe. People, especially in the United Kingdom, but I also noticed in other countries in Europe, people have sort of actually been much more aware of this approach to capital budgeting than they have in the United States. So let's next take a look at the formula here. Essentially, the way it works is very straightforward. When we think about value, what we do is to start out and ask a question, what is the book value of the asset in question? And then in the second process, what we do is to calculate that's called the present value of residual earnings. And when you think about residual earnings here, it has a very straightforward mathematical definition. It's defined as earnings. Now, keep in mind here, when I talk about earnings, I'm talking about accounting earnings. So it's accounting earnings minus rho minus 1, which is cost of capital, times the book value at the beginning of the year. So when you look at rho minus 1 times the book value at the beginning of the period, it's sort of like a charge for the use of capital. So earnings minus this charge for the use of capital we refer to as residual earnings. In other words, it's earnings after you allow for the cost of capital as measured by the accountant. And if you look at this formula here, the key thing to note here now is that when you think about projected residual earnings, we say that if those projected residual earnings are greater than zero, we tend to think about it as being a profitable performance. And if it's less than zero, it refers to as non-profitable performance. Now, it's not quite that easy because it really depends also upon the nature of the accounting measurements. But at least if we visualize that these numbers here be prepared using generally accepted accounting principles, then this is sort of what we have in mind here. Now, it's important to appreciate that this formula, as a matter of theory, is no less well-founded than the present value of cash flows. In other words, you cannot argue that this formula is going to give me the wrong solution and at the same time argue that using the present value of cash flows is going to give you the right solution. So this is a very important point of view here, is that there exists a general class of capital budgeting where you use accounting measures, and if you use these accounting measures, then you're going to end up with the correct conclusions as far as coming up with the best possible choice here. So please note here that this formula is consistent as with the maximization of shareholders' wealth as much as is the present value of cash flows. Okay, now at this stage here, there is really only one restriction that we impose on the earnings measurement, and this restriction has to do with the fact that the earnings have to satisfy what some people refer to as being clean surplus or comprehensive earnings. So when you think about earnings here, it's sort of going to be the cash flows plus an adjustment for the change in book value. Now, it's much easier to appreciate this formula if you think about the cash flows as sort of being like being a dividend paid by the project to the company. So essentially, then, from that point of view, earnings minus the dividends have to equal the change in the book value. So that's how this formula runs here. And let me quickly just run through the basic idea here. You know, so I have some numerical examples here. I think if you go to the bottom of the slide here, it's much easier to see what happens. The basic idea is very, very straightforward. It is sort of a notion that the sign of residual earnings depends upon how return on common equity compares with the discount factor. So if the return on common equity is greater than the discount factor, then residual earnings are positive. On the other hand, of course, if the return on common equity is less than the cost of equity capital, then residual earnings are negative. So I have some simple examples here if you just want to think about what's going on. Suppose you have a case when return on common equity is 20%. Let's assume that we have 15% of cost of capital. And let's assume you have a book value beginning of year is 100 or 100 million or whatever. Then the residual earnings is just going to be the difference between return on common equity and cost of capital. And then you multiply by the book value at the beginning of the period. And that then gives you the value added expected for that period. Okay, of course, and just as you have value added, you may have value deducted, and that, of course, occurs when the return on common equity is less than cost of capital. So the machinery here, or the mathematics here, is equally straightforward. Return on common equity, 10%, cost of capital, 15%, book value beginning of the year is 100. If you play around with these numbers, then the economic value added is a negative. In other words, residual earnings are minus 5. So that's sort of basically how this runs here now. And the next slide here is probably going to be the most important one. So let me now make some very key observations here. First observation, extremely important. You do notice here that as you look at this formula, the conclusion in terms of estimated market value works fine if you use cash flows. And essentially what you just have to visualize that cash flow analysis is exactly like using cash accounting. If you use cash accounting, then you don't really have any assets. So if you look at the special case here, when you put book value equal to 0, keep in mind here, this is an accounting measurement. So we're not suggesting that there are no assets. What we're suggesting here, of course, is just that in principle, you can use cash accounting. If you use cash accounting, then basically the book value of asset at all points in time, or the project at all points in time, is going to be 0. Now, if that's true, that's sort of equivalent to setting the cash flow equal to earnings. So that means that the residual earnings now are going to be exactly equal to the cash flows. So if you just plug everything into the formula, what pops up, of course, is that it is indeed the case that the value is equal to the present value of cash flows. So again, notice here what I said earlier is that when you think about the capital budgeting problem, then there's a class of approaches depending upon the accounting measurements. If you want to use cash accounting, that's fine, of course, provided that the planning horizon is equivalent to the project horizon. However, it should also be equally clear to you that there are really no reasons why we could not use accrual accounting in the capital budgeting problem. So when you think about that, then there's a very nice way of thinking about that in the economic value added approach. It's simply the idea here is that as we look at what's going to happen to this project, or the potential project, we start out assigning a book value which equals to the capital expenditures. Of course, if that's true, then the test is going to be, is any economic value added? So what you have to do now is to calculate the present value of residual earnings, assuming that the initial book value is equal to the capital expenditure. In other words, assuming that you're willing to deviate from cash accounting. This approach is actually used in practice. I mean, you shouldn't make any mistake here. It may be true that most textbooks tell you that you're supposed to use the present value of cash flows. However, there's a fairly well-known consulting outfit in the United States, which is called Stern Stewart. And they tell you, straight up, right away, EVA, economic value added, take the present value of residual earnings, and that's how you're going to do your capital budgeting. And just a few months ago, they actually had a very large, they had a very long article in Fortune about this mode of corporate. Analysis of capital expenditures. So it's sort of enormously intuitive, this, because basically what we're saying is very, very simple. If you start out initializing the book value as being equal to the capital expenditure. And if you project that the company, in some sense, on the average, is going to show a return on common equity that exceeds the discount factor, then the company is creating something of value, and the conclusion has to be that the project is a viable one. So notice here that when you think about this problem, you're not talking about the present value of cash flows. You're talking about accounting measurements, return on common equity, and you compare return on common equity to the discount factor, and the whole issue becomes, is it true that return on common equity on average exceeds the discount factor, and actual mathematics is in terms of residual earnings, and you just calculate the present value. Now, there's sort of a catch here to this, and I think this is also one of the more important points I'm going to make to this, and it has to do with the fact that when you look at this problem, under certain circumstances, you might find it quite reasonable to assume that at some point in time, the company is going to show average profitability. In other words, you may want to be willing to project and work with the presumption that 5, 10, 15 years down the line, the company's average residual earnings are going to be zero, because essentially what we're saying here is that return on common equity is roughly going to be equal to the discount factor. Now, if you do that, then you sort of get a very nice bonus. You can actually truncate your present value calculation. We now have an answer to the horizon problem. What should be the practical horizon problem? Well, essentially, when you prepare your pro forma, one way of going is to go to the point in time when you expect that the profitability you're going to see is just going to be the discount profitability. So this is, of course, extraordinarily useful because now we can make H less than the project horizon. So this is sort of how it works here now. And of course, at this point in time, you may, of course, ask the question, well, do we have any reasons to believe that the return on common equity is going to approximate the discount factor? Well, the answer to that question sort of hinges, of course, upon the nature of the accounting principles that you put in place. So what can you do at this point in time? Well, the one thing you can do is to look at, and this is what I've done, believe me, I spent more than a few hours on this, is that you can look at U.S. data, and what you can do is sort of compare return on common equity with market returns. In other words, essentially, we can use estimated average market returns as estimate of discount factors. And then you can look at average return on common equity. Now, if you go through that kind of exercise, you're going to find that on the whole, it's a reasonable assertion to state that in the United States over the last 30 years, roughly speaking, the average return on common equity tends to be very similar to the average market return, in other words, which would then be an estimate of average discount factor. If there's a bias, then one can reasonably assert that the bias goes in the direction that the market rate of return tends to be somewhat less than the book rate of return. Okay, and why does that happen? Well, it's really built into the formula. If the accounting is conservative, then on the average, the market value tends to be greater than the book value. If the market value on the average is greater than the book value, then you can also infer that on the average you're going to expect that the residual earnings are positive. So that's sort of really what goes on in the U.S. data. But as a reasonable approximation, the notion that on the average a company is going to show an average return on common equity, which is close to its discount factor, is a fairly reasonable proposition. So you notice here what happens is that we have actually come to grips here with the practical horizon problem. There's a prescription going on here in terms of how to approach the capital budgeting problem. Don't worry about cash flows. Worry about the accounting measures. Use an horizon that takes you to the point in time when you expect that the company is going to show average profitability. After you've done that, calculate residual earnings or value added for each and every period. Take the present value of that, and that's going to be the value added beyond your capital expenditures. So this is sort of an immensely practical way of looking at capital budgeting. It's not something academics can dream about. It's something that one can do and which is actually done in practice. And I think, from my, at least the way I view it, the aesthetics, the concepts, are actually much more appealing than looking at the cash flows. However, as we soon find out, that what we're really doing here is to come up with a model or a scheme of thinking about the problem, how to determine both the planning horizon and the continuing value in the original problem, you know, I was taking the present value of cash flows, but slightly modified with the idea that when you think about the continuing value, what you're supposed to do is to introduce accounting data. So that we can sort of go through some generalizations here, and we may want to make some assumption that the residual earnings do not approach zero, or they approach some constant. It turns out that that's not so comfortable from a theoretical point of view, but at least that's in principle doable. And in that case, of course, you're going to have the value of a project is equal to the capital expenditures plus the present value of residual earnings over the horizon plus sort of some very crude correction factor at the end. But you notice here that if you go through this kind of scheme, you have three terms. There's really no reason to expect that the third term is going to be very important as compared to the second term. And of course, if you make the horizon sufficiently long, then you don't need to worry about the third term at all. And so this correction factor here is very different from the kind of correction factor you encounter in the present value of cash flows. So here's what's really going on. And it's simply a model that says that if you project that the return on common equity is going to approach the discount factor at some horizon date, then the proper thing to do is to estimate the continuing value on the basis of the book value of the investment at that point in time. So that can be shown without too much difficulty as a matter of mathematics. Okay, so you notice what happens here is that essentially the whole issue becomes in the capital budgeting problem, we want to factor in accounting data. Now, if you want to factor that in by some systematic determination of the continuing value, that's fine. It is a modification of the present value of cash flows approach, because essentially what we're saying here is that the burden on estimating the market value of the project is going to be on the accounting data, not the cash flows that happen to accrue over the horizon. Okay, so that's what we're doing in this case now. Now, it turns out that there's a modification. Well, before I do that, let me just sort of quickly run through the implementation steps here. All I'm trying to do here is to convince you that there's absolutely nothing complicated going on in this approach toward capital budgeting. It's just a matter of making sure that you understand what the different steps are. So the basic input, of course, is that we're going to have some investment, and then we have to determine some discount factor. Now, I'm going to come back to this discount factor later on, but at least so far, we've got to specify some discount factor. Then, of course, we also have to visualize some staff work, where some people are going to sit down and make assumptions about future revenues, future expenses, prices, costs, markets, whatever have you. So once they are done, then, of course, depending upon on future profitability projection, we're going to have projections about return on book value, and that's going to be up to some horizon year. So ideally here now, just to remind you, is that the assumption is that once we reach this horizon, from then on we're going to assume that the return on common equity is going to be approximated by the discount factor. Of course, in addition, we're also going to have some growth in book value. And this growth in book value depends upon the profitability and the degree to which the profits are retained in the project. So if you visualize that you have a company acquiring a subsidiary or whatever have you, then typically you would expect that the growth in book value is going to be quite high. And of course, if the growth in book value is identical to the return on common equity, then the cash flows are going to be exactly equal to zero. So this is sort of, in some sense, the bottom line in your financial projections. You're really only concerned with two things: profitability and the growth in book value. Once you have that, then you can do some very simple calculations. You calculate your book value for investment. So that's just a matter of extracting that from the percentage growth in book value. Once you know that, you also know the book value at the end and the beginning of each and every period. You can also project the future earnings, and that's just a matter of applying the book values, take the return on common equity, and then you get your future earnings. So you do that for 8 years. If you want to, you don't have to, you can extract the cash flows. There's really no need for it. We don't need the cash flows number, but of course it's sort of lurking in the background. So you sort of got to keep in mind here is that it's not as if we are neglecting the cash flows. What we are doing, of course, is introduce accounting measurements that go beyond the cash flows. Okay, and once you're done with that, then you're ready to calculate residual earnings. You have earnings, you have a book values, you have a discount factors. So you can calculate the residual earnings for economic value, expect the economic value added for each and every period. And the next step, of course, is what you'll need to do is just to calculate present value. The question you ask is the number greater than zero, is it equal to zero, is it less than zero? And that's supposed to give you the conclusion. Now, it looks a little bit formal, this, but you should just sort of keep in mind here is that the intuition is very straightforward. Essentially, you're just sort of looking at average future return on common equity and compare that with your discount factor. You're looking for projects where return on common equity are exceeding the discount factors. Okay, so that's sort of all you do, keeping in mind that somewhere along the line, return on common equity has to stabilize and become equal to the discount factor. Now, I also like to note here, as a matter of practice, that the way things usually go is that when we project the return on common equity, percent return on book value, usually the input is broken down into the profit margin and the asset turnover. So this is sort of what you find in the typical documents in corporate financial planning. The income statement reduces to a profit margin, and then you check up the profitability of the book value in terms of the sales by calculating the asset turnover. Once you projected these numbers for 4 or 5 or whatever the horizon is, then you take the products, and that gives you a certain return on book value, and you have the growth in the book value that reflects the capital expenditures, and then you run the whole thing through, and in the end you're going to end up with, of course, a conclusion concerning how appropriate these capital expenditures are. Before I go on here, I would like to make some very quick theoretical comments. And these points here are a little bit obtuse, I guess. It's just a matter of what I'm really trying to do is to convince you that the quality of this formula is as good as it gets in our business. So in particular, the important point I'd like to make here, for those of you interested in theory, is that the formula can derive from very primitive assumptions concerning how an economy functions. And the basic idea here is that, which one can sort of show, is that if you sort of visualize that you have two companies or two projects, and if one has greater book value than another, and more in residual earnings for sure, in future periods, then it must be worth, otherwise you have arbitrage opportunities. And I also like to point out here is that the way the formula is laid out in the prior transparency is sort of a simplification of much more general formula. In particular, the one thing I haven't dealt with very explicitly is what happens if you have a very complicated term structure of interest rates, how to deal with risk and whatever have you. So the formula actually is much more general than appears from the slide. And that statement is very similar to the same problem you have when it comes to the present value of cash flows. In other words, in reality, the identification of discount factors and adjustment for risk is much more complicated than is usually suggested by the textbooks, at least from a theory point of view. So it's sort of important that you appreciate that from a point of view of theory, it's not the formula that you just put up as a suggestion as something you might want to do. This formula can be derived from very, very elementary assumption concerning the nature of value maximization, and therefore it sort of has, you know, very good theoretical standing. And it's sort of also important that you understand here is that the application of this formula is entirely consistent with all sorts of concepts of risk, like capital asset pricing model, APT, or whatever have you. And the final point I'd like to make here is a little bit difficult to make, but essentially what happens is that once you move to an accounting environment with accrual accounting, the one thing you find out is that residual earnings are going to be much less sensitive to alternative assumptions about companies' future capital expenditures. See, part of the problem with the present value of cash flows formula is that the actual cash flows you end up with hinge crucially on assumptions about future capital expenditures. But once you move to sort of the residual earnings approach, then well, the one thing you would sort of come to appreciate is that even though you change the assumptions about the growth in book value, the residual earnings on the whole are not going to change that much. So the idea here is that the use of residual earnings, given that you use generally accepted accounting principles, is going to give you much more robust numbers. So therefore, if you ever engage in any kind of sensitivity analysis using the present value of residual earnings, you're going to find that these numbers that enter the formula are much less sensitive than what would happen if you use sensitivity analysis and look at the present value of actual cash flows. So that's sort of another reason why this approach has much merit to it. Okay, the next thing I would like to do is to talk about an alternative approach here, which has to do with the limitations to the present value of residual earnings. Keep in mind what I said earlier here is that you can only truncate the calculation if, in fact, return on common equity is going to approach the discount factor. Now, under some circumstances, you really cannot make such an assumption. And what you can sort of visualize in particular is that if you have a company, if you have a project which is sort of intrinsically quite profitable, and you invoke and use accounting principles that are relatively conservative, and then you combine that with a growth environment. Now, in that kind of case, what happens is that the residual earnings will remain positive, and they will also become quite large. So you can, in some sense, you can't really quite get rid of them. So that means now what we want to do here is to come to grips with this problem. And essentially what we're going to do is going to come up with an alternative way of thinking about how one determines continuing value. The approach is remarkably simple and extremely practical as far as I'm concerned. Essentially, the estimate of the value of a project now is based on a very, very simple two-stage procedure, which is sort of very similar to the present value cash flow formula. You're going to do three things here. First, you just add up earnings that's going to accrue on the project. So you can sort of visualize that we establish some horizon. I'm going to have more to say about that later. So you just add up the earnings of the project. Then the next thing is that you have to consider the timing of the cash flows, because to the extent there are cash flows that are coming out of the project, then of course these cash flows could be used for purposes of earning money to the companies that's to generate earnings by the companies investing in this project. So what we need here now, next, is just a capitalization factor. So that's given by the discount factor taken to the power of H. Now keep in mind here is that the sum of earnings is over H years, so the capitalization factor has to be consistent with what you have in the numerator. So that means that if you have a 10-year planning horizon, then you would have 1.12, which would be rho taken to the power of 10, and then you deduct 1. So you notice here that the capitalization factor here is going to grow with the horizon. But the same thing is going to happen in the numerator. The longer you make H, the more you're going to have in aggregate earnings. So what you're trying to do is sort of stabilize this whole thing, and then you're going to come up with an estimate of the value of the project. So that's sort of actually contribution. And then you just compare the value of this project, in other words, V hat, with capital expenditures, and on that basis you should arrive at the proper conclusion. Now, this approach here to capital budgeting, it actually works perfectly if you assume, and you got to sort of be listening a bit carefully here, if you assume that the continuing value is just equal to the book value plus the value added in the project. So the general idea here is that if a company actually can engage in the project and generate some value, we sort of assume that's sort of like a perpetuity. So the value added today, which is the difference between the V hat and the book value today, we assume that that's going to remain constant over future years. So if that holds at any given point in time, then it turns out that this formula gives you exactly the right conclusion. In terms of from a point of view of theory. Okay, now you also have to keep in mind here that if you worry about how this formula works and introducing sort of errors of inference, the one way you can always eliminate the errors of inference is by letting the planning horizon become very long. So if you sort of visualize that we actually push H to infinity, which is equal to then T, then again you're going to end up with the correct conclusion. So this is a remarkable simple formula. All you have to do here is to add up the earnings. And you do notice here that under some reasonable scenarios, the second term you have here, earnings on the cash flows, compared to the first term, is going to be very small in magnitude. So this is sort of precisely what happens if you visualize the case when you have a company that is going to reinvest most, where the project is such that the earnings generated by the project is sort of basically reinvested. In that case, the cash flows are lousy, and the only thing you really care about is the sum of earnings over the life of the project, or which may be infinite, and then you otherwise are going to just have approximations. So let me next sort of run through a very simple numerical example how this works out. And it's very non-complicated. And the point to be made here is that we're using some very basic accounting input. And essentially what we're saying here is that the solution you're going to come up with is the right one, even though we're not actually calculating the present value of cash flows. We're focusing on the accounting numbers. Of course, the applications of every formula require some assumptions. So let's assume here that we have an investment of 100. And let's assume that we have a cost of capital of 14%. And then we can sort of visualize that we have a horizon of 3 years, and we have certain projections. So we start out with 100. Notice here that the book value beginning of year X1, which is the current year, or the upcoming year, is exactly identical to the investment. So that becomes very critical here. So notice here that the 100 here is exactly put equal to the 100 here. So the accountant, in some sense, is going to record the capital expenditures, put that on the book, and then, of course, in the future, we're going to have changes in the asset composition, and that depends upon future capital expenditures. and whatever have you. So the next thing we do is that we project some return on common equity. So you notice here that the projected return on common equity the first year is 10%. So the earnings are 10. And then depending upon the projected future capital expenditures, then we're going to have the book value at the end of the year. So I'm putting in 115 here. So essentially what we're saying here is that for this kind of project, what we visualize is that the company that's investing in the project is going to have to come up with more money the subsequent year. And the reason is that the company has yet to show much profitability, or the project has yet to show profitability, and there's still significant growth in the underlying asset base. And then we move on to X2 here, and things are picking up because the profitability is going up. 115, earnings generated 20, so the profitability now is like 18%. Capital expenditures are slowing down somewhat. So in the second year, the cash flows are 15. And the third year is sort of the same mechanics here. We have to project book value, earnings, and growth in book value, and that gives us the cash flows here. So this is sort of the data we can visualize here. And there's nothing mysterious about what's going on. And if you sort of want to think about what's happening, is that these are the kind of numbers you would face if you invest in a company as an investor. The only difference is that rather than talking about cash flows, you would talk about dividends. So then the question becomes here, if you see these kind of numbers, is this a worthwhile capital expenditure to make? Well, let's check out what Vanguard earnings are. So we take the 10, 20, and 25, and I hope I've done this correctly, they add up to 55. And then we have to look at our second term, which is the correction for the earnings on the cash flows. So the first year here, we have 1.14 taken to the power of 2. The idea, of course, is that the cash flows that has to be put in or at the end of year 1, so they're going to have to, has to be a penalty for 2 years. So you have 1.14 taken to the power of 2 minus 1 times the 5 year, that refers to the negative cash flows. So then in the second year, you have the positive cash flows, and that's just now going to be for 1 year. So you have 1.14 minus 1 times 15, and that's the net here is 0.6. So in this example, and this is sort of what tends to happen in most cases, even in textbooks, is that the cash flows are not very important in the grand scheme of things. What really counts here is how we think about the continuing value. So the total here is 55.6, and then we have to capitalize that over a 3-year period. So you notice here that we take 1.14, take to the power of 3, and deduct 1, so that's going to be 0.48. So this is a 3-year capitalization factor, and that gives us then 115.8, and that exceeds 100. So this is a very, very simple exercise in capital budgeting. And what are the assumptions to make sure that this is the theoretically valid conclusion? Well, the assumption here has to be that in order to have no error, it doesn't have to be true exactly, of course, in order to arrive at the correct conclusion. But this approach here will be 100% correct, so to speak, if we assume that the continuing value at the end of year 3 is equal to the book value at the end of year 3 plus the value that's generated by the project. The value generated by the project is 15.8. In other words, the value of the project is 115.8, the capital expenditures is 8, so the net value generated by the project is 15.8. So if you add the 15.8 to the 130, then you get 145.8. Okay, so that's essentially what we're saying here, that for this particular case, if you're willing to assume that the continuing value is 145.8, which is sort of based on certain concepts, then you're going to end up with a conclusion concerning the value of the project. So you notice here that, in a certain sense, what we're doing, of course, is that we're not really deviating from the present value cash flows approach, provided that you allow me to introduce accounting data. So it's not the pure present value of cash flows approach. It's sort of, we're looking at the cash flows, but we have to worry about the continuing value. And what we try to do is to think about the continuing value in a systematic fashion. So that's sort of how all these approaches differ from each other. Now, let me then next just make some related points here concerning some useful approximations if you use this approach. Okay, the first one, of course, is that the simplest possible way of looking at a project is just to ask the question, I mean, how much is this project going to earn us for us next year? And then you divide by capitalization factor. And is that a reasonable approach? Well, it really, of course, depends upon if assumptions are satisfied. But in general, I mean, we tend to be a little bit myopic, and if there are any sort of measurement errors in accounting earnings, then you're going to end up in trouble. But nevertheless, as a first very simple approximation, whenever you think about a capital budgeting problem, first thing you can do is just ask, you know, what's going to be earned next year? Now, the next thing you can do, and I think this is sort of a remarkably overlooked aspect of the capital budgeting problem. In fact, a lot of textbooks always make sort of a point that you should never look at the payback criteria, and what you're always supposed to do is take the present value of cash flows. Well, that's certainly true if you want to look at cash flows. However, if you want to look at earnings, the story is very different. So one very basic question here that you can ask, and it's a very, very simple question, is just to ask the question that if we go ahead in this project, how many years is it going to take earnings are going to be equal to the investment? And that's sort of a good old payback criterion. And it goes almost without saying that if a discount factor is 15, 16, or 14%, and is going to take you 20 years before aggregate earnings add up to your investment, it probably is not a very good project. So this can be done, and the reality is, of course, that people in the business world, they do this all the time. They may have advanced degrees, they might have taken 15 executive courses where they're taught every fine trick in terms of the capital budgeting, but the reality is once you have the projected financial statements in front of you, the temptation is just too good. It's just a matter of checking up, you know. Are we going to rack up any earnings? How many years do I have to wait before my earnings add up to the cash flows? So this is a very, very good approximation, provided that the cash flows are relatively unimportant. In other words, it is a very useful approximation, provided that, in some sense, most of the value is going to be in the continuing value. So this is sort of, whenever I teach executives, I actually sort of always emphasize that what they have been doing is really a very, very good first approximation to the whole capital budgeting problem. And it's sort of a nice way of looking at it, because it's sort of very easy to implement, and it is difficult to go wrong unless you're talking about a project which is sort of essentially liquidating in nature. In other words, the continuing value is relatively unimportant. Okay, there's another very nice aspect of this, and it has to deal with the fact, with the problem of the discount factor. I mentioned earlier tonight that the one problem people encounter when we try to apply capital budgeting is that the solutions tends to be very, very sensitive to the choice of discount factor. So the way we try to deal with that in practice is not to sort of look at every project you come up with and try to figure out which ones have positive present value and which ones have negative present value. That tends to be an element of capital rationing. And then in those kind of conditions, in some sense, what companies want to do is to pick what are the best projects. And that means that what you look at, we have these profitability indexes, which is sort of really the value of a project divided by the initial capital expenditure, and that tends to serve as a profitability index. So when you do that, then what you really would like to do is sort of to rank projects in such a fashion that the ranking is not sensitive to the choice of discount factor, assuming that all projects are equally risky. So that's sort of also enormously important from a practical matter, because businessmen, they don't like to sort of sit down and calculate and say that this project has positive present value, therefore we're going to go ahead. But what they really like to do is line up a string of projects and then pick out of the many that show positive present value, what they want to do is to sort of identify the ones that are the most profitable. So once you look at the problem from that point of view, it becomes very natural that you really want to come up with a scheme that allows you to rank projects regardless of the discount factor, assuming that all projects in some sense should deserve the same discount factor, even though we don't know what the appropriate discount factor is. Well, the way that works is extraordinarily simple. It's an approximation here. One way you can do that is just to look at two projects, check up how much they're going to earn over some horizon. And if you see a project that's going to generate twice as much earnings as another project, then of course the value, relatively speaking, should be twice. So that sort of then very quickly gives you a sense of the relative profitability, because you can then sort of, to make things simple, assume that both projects have the same initial capital expenditure. So this is, in my mind, of enormous practical importance, and I think and I hope that in the future the textbooks in corporate finance will pay much more attention to these kind of concepts. You notice what's going on here is very, very simple. Essentially what we're saying here is that the nature of a game is to incur capital expenditures and generate earnings as fast as possible and as rapidly as possible. And presumably, if you can generate earnings at a fairly high rate given your capital expenditures, you're going to make good investments. And presumably, that's then going to translate into a higher stock price. That's going to be something I'm going to talk about firstly, in terms of the empirical evidence and how the empirical evidence is very consistent with the idea that that if you, in some sense, buy your earnings cheaply, then the investments are panning out in the measures that you really care about, which is sort of the market rate of return. Okay, I notice here that I'm sort of approaching the end of my talk, so I'm going to skip a few of the last slides. And what I'd like now to do is just to summarize what were the basic points I was trying to make tonight. Okay, three basic points here now, and I think now you sort of, I hope that by now you sort of have an appreciation of what the underlying logic is. First of all, you should never fall into the trap and ever believe that the only way of doing capital budgeting is by taking the present value of cash flows. It's a big mistake. That is not the same thing as saying that you can't do it. It's just a matter of keeping very, very firmly in mind that there are accounting-based approaches using ordinary accrual accounting which are equally sound in their conceptual foundation. So that's the first point you want to firmly come to grasp with. The second point, if you use different approaches, and the different approaches are going to give you the same conclusion anyhow, and this will happen, of course, if you make the planning horizon equal to the project horizon, then one can argue that there's no reason why you want to look at accounting data. You might as well only look at the cash flows. So the obvious point in case here is that if the continuing value is going to be zero because you have a finite project, there's really no useful purpose to be served by introducing accounting earnings, because you know what the conclusion is going to be identical if you just took the present value of the cash flows. So there are merits to taking the present value of cash flows from a point of view that in some sense it can be viewed as simple. After all, as many accounting teachers can tell you, accounting is a very complicated subject, and most people never quite grasp it. So under those kind of conditions, of course, you may want to use the present value of cash flows. Okay, and I should sort of mention that if you look at capital budgeting in practice, what happens, of course, is that it's precisely for the kind of project where you have a low continuing value, where the project horizon is sufficiently long relative to the continuing value, the present value of the continuing value. Those are the industry, these are the kind of projects where you actually see documents that shows that the focus is on the present value of cash flows. So one example in particular is if you look at the acquisition of real estate. The acquisition of real estate tends to be based on documents that's focused solely on the present value of cash flows. But that's, of course, because if you look at one piece of real estate, then it makes sense. You can go out 20 years, and probably in the grand scheme of things, the continuing value, relatively speaking, is not going to be that important. Okay, and finally, the last point here, which you want to keep in mind here, is that if you want to use projected accounting data in your financial analysis, then there is a role for evaluating accounting principles. So I sort of need to remind you here about the fact that in all applications of projected earnings and projected book values, you have to be willing to make some assumptions about how they relate to the continuing value. So in the case of the use of the approach where you took the present value of residual earnings, you have to assume that the accounting measures work in such a fashion that at the project horizon, you can expect to have return on common equity to be equal to to the discount factor at some horizon date and from then on. And you also notice that when it came to the concept of buying earnings, there is an implicit assumption there that the difference between the book value and the intrinsic project value at the time of the horizon is going to be exactly equal to the value that was created in the first place. Now, it turns out that all of these approaches here, sort of essentially only two approaches, these approaches, they can be modified. And essentially, depending upon how you want to visualize how the world plays out at the time of the horizon, you come up with alternative models of the continuing value. So once you have that solution, then you sort of are pretty much on firm grounding. So from that point of view, we're sort of back to square one. In other words, that if you look at the corporate finance textbooks, they have this fairly extensive emphasis on that the only thing you can do is look at the present value of cash flows. So that point is always hammered in. But then they tend to introduce a continuing value, and then that just sort of raises the whole issue. How do you determine the continuing value? That's where the accounting data comes in. So once you look at the problem from that point of view, the task at hand becomes one of thinking about the accounting measurements and how they interact with the economic environment. So you come up with some notions about what determines the continuing value. And once you have that, then you're going to arrive at the correct conclusion. So they're sort of going to be, it's sort of possible to refine these kind of capital budgeting approaches using accounting data. Some of these I'm going to allude to first here. They sort of get increasingly technical. Let me here just sort of mention that the most general approach is one of really thinking about the continuing value as being a weighted average of capitalized earnings and the book value at the horizon date. That can actually be modeled. That provides for a fairly general framework once one knows how to establish the weights. So it sort of simply means that as you undertake any business project, once you have an horizon, then the question is, what's the business worth at that point in time? What you naturally want to do, of course, is look at the projected earnings, projected book value at that time, which is precisely how you think about businesses when you invest in the stock market. You look at the current earnings and the current book value at the present point in time in order to try to estimate the value. So that's sort of pretty much my little story. And as I indicated to you, Thursday, what I plan to do is to show you that once you look at accounting data and stock market prices, you will find out that the creation of value is very closely related to what happens to the accounting data. And in fact, the one key result I'm going to try to demonstrate that empirically, if you ever find yourself in a situation where the aggregate earnings are very high relative to the initial value, in other words, the price in the case of the stock market, then you're going to find out that you have a great investment. And the empirical evidence in that regard is remarkably strong. And in addition, the evidence I plan to provide you is that when you think about aggregate earnings, there's really no need to worry about the components. There's sort of always this temptation that somehow cash expenses are different from the depreciation expense. The empirical reality is entirely different. When you think about an income statement with the right framework, you're going to find out that all expenses are equal in nature, all revenues are equal in nature, and you don't need to worry about the composition of revenues and expenses. I'm also planning to demonstrate that when you think about the balance sheet, the same conclusion is available. It is not as if the stock market thinks that somehow cash is a better asset than accounts receivable, inventory, prepaid expenses, property, plant, and equipment, and even intangible assets. The evidence is remarkably strong that as far as the market is concerned, revenues are revenue, and expenses are expense, and assets is an asset, and liability is a liability. So from that point of view, it really comes back to basics here, is that accrual accounting is doing a remarkably good job, at least as far as I'm concerned, in terms of trying to sifting out the whole process in society of creating value to the stockholders, and as also is reflected in the process of making capital budget decisions. So, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that. Can I remind you that this series of lectures continues on Thursday, but between now and then, we have a reception in the senior common room to which you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.